Claritas is an industry leader in providing brands, agencies, and publishers with a complete closed-loop marketing platform to help marketers identify their right potential customers more precisely, deliver more effective multi-channel campaigns across audiences' preferred channels, and optimize campaigns more accurately and efficiently through a robust attribution and incremental lift analysis measuring both online and offline channels, including podcast, digital audio, and advanced television. Claritas's offerings are strengthened by the recent acquisition of Arts AI, integrating AI-powered technology to underpin an already robust identity graph, which fuels the accuracy, effectiveness, and efficiency of all their solutions. Claritas is committed to being an independent third-party partner, providing marketers with an unbiased and objective approach for building, executing, and measuring online and offline marketing campaigns. Find out more at Claritas.com.
Welcome to Great Minds, and our guest today is Elizabeth Brennan. Elizabeth is the general manager, oversees all advertising for Permutive, which is one of the more interesting companies in the marketplace right now that is in the center of the whole conversation around data and privacy. Elizabeth, you're in England, so I'll say privacy.
Thank you.
And sort of the evolution of the post-cookie, if we get there, which I think we will, ecosystem. So I'm delighted to have you here, Elizabeth. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Matt. I'm delighted to be here too.
So Elizabeth, you have such an interesting background, and I'm a very big fan of thinking that you can always improve at things, even if you're not that good at them. And I've worked very hard at a lot of things that I wasn't very good at to advance to, let's call it, mediocrity. And I'm a great believer in coaching. I know that coaching is a very big part of who you are. So I'd love to go back and talk about some of the stuff that's part of your DNA, looking at things like the Coactive Training Institute and just, you know, part of who you are, you know, going beyond the business.
Such an interesting question, Matt. I think I'm a very curious person, and I'm particularly curious about people and what motivates them, what drives them, what makes them happy, what makes them successful. And I love light bulb moments. And I think when you combine a curiosity about people with an ability to drive a light bulb moment for them, that is absolutely magic. I love the Coactive Training Institute because one of their sort of foundational principles is that they believe the answer is within everybody. And your job as a coach is to hold that person in a space where they can see the path for themselves, where they want to get to, how they should design that. And I remember the first time I worked with a coach, it was just totally transformational. And the notion of being able to help other people on that journey or unlock something for them was just, I mean, it's just the best.
Great answer. Is there an uptick that you see in business coaching? I've got a lot of friends who have come out of the industry. I know you spent some time at Mindshare, which we'll touch on. My friend Mark Crichton had a very big job in media over there, is now a coach. Another dear friend of mine over here, Rob Schwartz, who was chair of TBWA New York, and we've worked together on a lot of wonderful projects together. Rob is now a coach, just went to Brown University to get his certification as a business coach. Tell me what you see there in the uptick, because it seems like this is a hot area right now, not just coaching as it relates to athletic endeavors, but as it relates to business endeavors.
It's fascinating, isn't it? I think there is not a more humble leadership coming through, but I think there's a leadership coming through that's not afraid to ask for help and not afraid to say that they need help either. And that lends itself to coaching sort of inherently. I do think also that coaching and facilitating, and this notion of a good idea can come from wherever, can come from any person in a business, but you generally need like a neutral party to make that happen. And I think what's interesting about working with a coach versus perhaps a mentor or a manager is that person in, who you're working with at that moment has no agenda but to get you to where you want to be. And I think if you are, you know, an executive at the top of a business, your board has an agenda, the other executive people around the table have an agenda, everyone who you manage has an agenda, your coach is your confidant, the person who you can feel most confident in the world that they just want to help you get to where you need to be. And whether that is, you know, growing your media agency, or whether that is, when I was a Criteo, the UK market was going backwards. By the time I left, it was in growth. And I believe that the coach I worked with, a wonderful lady called Nina, helped me to do that, helped me to get there. And it was having this very safe space to explore ideas, and also to have somebody who's not afraid at any point to ask you a really difficult question. What if you did this? What if you pressed this button? What happens if you do this? And you explore those kind of concepts in a space that there's no real consequences for that conversation happening. You know, you're simply talking to someone who's going to hold a mirror up to your decisions and make sure that if you make very difficult decisions, you're going to be able to go to sleep at night. And that's, I think, why coaching has grown and is growing so fast, is because leaders value having that person in their lives.
Yeah, and I think that notion you said is the key, that it's someone who's giving you advice without agenda.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Really interesting stuff. So let's dial the clock back a little bit. Your academic training is in economics.
Yes.
And you have this, you know, hybrid in your early formative, you know, business years, as a passionate advocate for professional women, embracing coding and coaching and training, which we've talked about. That's an odd sort of mixture of disciplines.
It is, isn't it? I mean, I remember doing work experience in creative agencies and media agencies when I was in the sixth form, so kind of 16, 17. And I really loved media because of the data, because of the richness of the information that was available that you could make decisions based upon. And I guess that is the economic training. You know, economics is what are people's preferences? What is the trends telling us? And when I went into media, that's what you were able to do at a really macro level. You know, we were, especially as a planner and as a strategist, a customer comes to you with a business problem and your job is to find data, find insight, and build, you know, media plans that are exciting, new and innovative based on this information. I did coding because when I was at Criteo, I felt insecure about how weak my technical knowledge was. And every so often, somebody in the technical team would tell me something wasn't possible. And I kind of had a hunch it was. So I went out and learned how to do a bit of coding, just to give myself, I guess, that enough knowledge to be dangerous, I think is something that my dad would say.
Yeah, no, I love that expression. So your passion for media sounds like, you know, was formed pretty early, and you end up at a great, great shop for about a 5-year run, working on some big, big clients, including Unilever's business at Mindshare.
Oh, yeah, that was fantastic. I loved my time at Mindshare. I mean, it was an incredible agency. Jed Glanville was the CEO when I started, and then Mark Crichton was the CEO for the rest of my tenure there. And when I was at Mindshare, our mission as a business was to invent the future of media for our clients. And I love that. I worked with some incredibly smart people and learned, you know, so much about how to interrogate a brief and to think broadly and strategically about business problems. It was a fantastic time in my career, and it was such a privilege to work on businesses like Unilever that have these you know, enormous heritage brands. I worked on Dove and just, you know, felt privileged to be a part of that journey for that time. It was a wonderful time.
And that was a period of time going back about a dozen years or so ago when, you know, I guess you'd say the early days of true digital transformation was really happening. You know, when we started Advertising Week back in 2004, Facebook was still on the Harvard campus. We were 3 years away from YouTube. We were several years away from the iPhone. It almost seems like we're going back to, you know, prehistoric times in referencing things like that. But when you were at Mindshare, that was a moment in time where the business was really evolving.
Oh yeah, I think I was lucky to work through that really evolutionary period. I mean, I remember when there was one person in the agency who knew anything about mobile. And, you know, mobile was going to be huge. And I remember the first kind of programmatic vendors coming in and how innovative the media plans started to become and layering in audience targeting and taking that data, putting it across, you know, the media planning process. All of a sudden, the way in which you were able to work with a customer, the way in which you were able to deliver media for them became, you know, very exciting, very real time, and quite different to perhaps more traditional ways that we had planned and bought media. But it was, it was a crazy sort of growth period and felt very different to kind of, I think, how people feel about programmatic now, which is, I think now we feel a bit concerned about what it's become. And obviously the industry is changing, regulation is changing. But at that time, I think the open marketplace is being built as somewhere that, you know, data was ubiquitous. It was there to be used for customers in the right way. It's a kind of a fascinating time to look back on now.
So with your old hat on, going back to Mindshare, and then I know you spent some time with Zenith Optimedia as well, and with your current hat on at Permutive, give us your take on the industry's success and failings working in what has been largely an unregulated environment. Government historically is late to the party. Typically behind. I'm always amazed anytime you see a hearing where, you know, every once in a while there'll be some issue will crop up and there'll be hearings in Washington and they'll drag, you know, top executives from Facebook and, or Meta, I should say, and Google and Microsoft, et cetera. The big players, you know, will be hauled off to Washington to, be questioned. And I marvel at the lack of understanding of our most senior people. Remember, there was one question, I think it was Chuck Grassley, who's give or take 85, you know, had no idea how the internet worked, and in the most fundamental way. And I think it was one with Mark Zuckerberg was in the hot seat. It's almost like they were back in the days of AOL dial-up. And I wonder, how is it that their staffs don't do a better job preparing them? That was the question I had. But give us your take on how the industry has done navigating brilliantly and maintaining it an environment which is largely self-regulated.
I think you know, the advertising industry has remained largely self-regulated, right? So you've got people like the Advertising Standards Authority who hold advertisers to account in terms of you can or cannot say this, you cannot use this messaging. I think in order to be held to account, you have to have a very deep understanding of the mechanisms of how the internet works. And I don't just mean that if we agree to adverts on publishers on websites, the internet stays free. I think most people understand that. I think there's then another layer of understanding that there's a value exchange. And if I give over some data, i.e. my browsing data, then I'm going to continue to receive said content for free, and the internet remains free, and that's a good thing because I use the internet. I think where regulators are kind of always going to struggle unless they hire people from the industry is you really, really, really have to understand the mechanisms very deeply and the sort of data collection and the sort of data ubiquity that exists in order to power the machines that the internet runs upon, and the number of data points, the number of data signals that kind of the open programmatic world uses is billions. And there's a lot of data sharing that happens, and there is not always transparency within the supply chain. And by that, I mean, it's not always clear to advertisers of the dollar they spend in digital advertising, how much actually ends up with the publisher and who else is taking a slice of the pie out in the middle. And unless you kind of get to grips with the minutiae of the detail of all of these different mechanisms, it's incredibly difficult to unpick through regulation. What should we be regulating and how should it be regulated? I do think customer privacy is something that hasn't been prioritized historically through the industry. And that's really where the regulators have stepped in now. But even before I think regulators have stepped in, you know, consumers have taken matters into their own hands. This privacy value exchange is no longer working for them. And as a result, they have decided to, in their droves, opt out of a cookie-based advertising world. So right now, addressability in the open web is as low as 30%, which means 50% of people who use the open web, and by the open web, I mean, you know, things outside the walled gardens, 50% of those people no longer use Chrome. And of the remaining Chrome users, 40% of those people have opted out of third-party cookies. So if an advertiser today is spending in the open web, fundamentally, they can only reach 30% of users. And that's because these users have got frustrated and tired of waiting for there to be a better way of working. And I guess that's my take on it, really.
I love that. Give us reflections further, drawing on your time at Criteo, which is a big player in this space. And then I want to get to Permutive and, you know, really dive into the whole data and privacy conversation. But you have real perspective, having worked on the media agency side for some awfully big clients, Unilever being just one of them. And I think this is such an important area for our business. My own sentiment is the industry has largely bungled self-regulation. And at some point, and the EU is a little bit ahead of America, I would say, maybe more than a little, but they have benefited greatly by the ignorance and the inability of the public sector to really step up in a big way. And I imagine some of that is the result of significant amounts of money being spent on lobbying. And certainly in America right now, a lot of what happens in Washington is influenced by lobbyists. That's the reality. And I think we would all be shocked to hear the size of the lobbying operations the bigger players have in DC, how much money they spend, internal resources, external resources, former members of the House and Senate on the payroll. So interesting area.
Very, very interesting. And yeah, I had such an interesting time at Criteo, and Criteo was a company that was very good to me. I had no commercial experience going into Criteo, but they had a problem, which is they didn't know how to work with media agencies, and I'd only ever worked in a media agency. So it was quite a symbiotic relationship there. The Criteo business that I worked in is very different to the Criteo business that exists now, which is essentially a retail media business. I think the core part of the Criteo retargeting business was funded by, you know, a piece of technology that took billions and billions of data points across retail websites, travel websites, and publishers' websites, and built a very, very smart bit of machine learning that could essentially predict customers' behaviors and whether they would transact and what they'd transact on and the environment, etc. It was a business I ultimately left because I didn't feel hugely comfortable with the way that they were using that data and the way that regulation was going was a way that I agreed with. I believed customers should have choice about the way that their data is used and that data should be used with, you know, the utmost integrity. And not for one second saying that Criteo doesn't have integrity, but it was just somewhere that I kind of needed to leave.
Well, the whole targeting, retargeting business, you know, is, you know, it's a very, very big business. And like in any business, there are good actors and bad actors and those that are in between. Let's dig into that whole issue, Elizabeth, which we've touched on, about how consumers have effectively traded their privacy for all the, quote, free stuff we get to do on our mobile devices.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, isn't it? Because sometimes I become aware that I operate in an industry echo chamber where everybody like you and I guess to some extent or another, understands what it means to click yes and to consent to your data being used. If I was to sit down with my dad, who is a retired architect, and I asked him what happens if you click this accept button, his understanding of what happens when that button is accepted is deeply different to ours. And I think that the issue comes down to the expectation of an internet user perhaps consenting to sharing data with that one website, that data owner, if you like, versus consenting to third-party cookies or third-party providers then taking their data and using it for other purposes on other websites. And I think that's really the difference, is somebody consenting with the understanding and knowledge of what they are consenting to. And I would hasten to guess that probably anybody listening to this who operates in our world is fully aware that there will be players on there who are taking that data and using it elsewhere. But it's not my belief that people who operate outside of the digital marketing industry really understand the mechanics and the pipes through which that data is then fed.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think if most people were aware,
they'd be horrified.
Yeah, I think they would. So let's talk about Permutive. You've been there a couple of years. You start off in a strategy role. Talk about the journey to get there, and you've climbed up the ladder pretty quick, now moving up to general manager.
Yeah, so I worked with an absolutely lovely man called Ali Nur Muhammad, who was with me at Criteo. So we worked together at Criteo. And he gave me a phone call one rainy November and said, we want to build an advertiser business, but none of us have worked with any advertisers. And would you be prepared to have a conversation with our CEO, a great man called Joe Root? And I had a conversation with Joe, and I thought, God, I got to work for this guy. He's, you know, really inspirational. I loved his vision for what he wanted to do. And so then ensued sort of 4 or 6 weeks of conversations and interviews, and I was invited to join the Permutive business, really to define how they should work with advertisers and to make sure that they built the right product to go to market with. And Permutive as a business wants to rebuild data and advertising to protect privacy. And to do that, they've built a really huge and successful publisher business. And now advertisers face a world where, as we were chatting about earlier, you know, Google stood on stage today at Demexco saying, by the end of 2024, there will be no cookies left on Chrome. All of a sudden, advertisers need pipes into publisher inventory that they were previously using the open marketplace for. And that's really what my job is, to build the right product, to build the right go-to-market. And I work with a team of 11 incredibly smart, driven individuals in order to kind of meet that challenge.
What a great story. So talk about that ecosystem as it evolves for publishers. It seems like we are all at the mercy of iOS and Android. And one little tweak on either and a business model can be completely upended. What's your take on that and where Permutive fits in that conversation for publishers?
Well, that's how the publisher business for Permutive was built. There was this enormous section of a publisher's website that operates on iOS. It's kind of 40% in the UK. I think in the US, it could go up to 60% of all traffic that publishers were unable to monetize through the existing technology stack that they had and they were using. And that's where our founders, Joe and Tim, built a product. So the publisher product that we have built and that's operational in market today really ensures that a publisher understands every single user that comes to their site, regardless of the environment that they come to their site in. They can build very sophisticated and innovative first-party data strategies that then they can go out and sell to advertisers in market and improve and grow the revenue that's coming to them through direct channels and direct ways of working. So that's how we have sought to protect publishers in this sort of direct way of working that we have with advertisers. Part of my remit is making sure that we help publishers to mitigate the risk that sits with them right now in the open marketplace revenue. So that open marketplace revenue is pretty much all driven by cookies. If there are no cookies, they need a way to shore up that revenue stream, because for some publishers, it's very, very significant and critical to their P&L. So that's what we're seeking to do, help publishers move revenue out of an open marketplace programmatic and into private marketplaces and bring advertisers along with us on that journey and speak to advertisers about the fact that if they can't reach people in the open marketplace to the degree to which they think they can, that not only hurts their brand equity, but ultimately, you know, it hurts their P&L.
And tell me how it's going. It's been about 2 years. I'm going to guess that that early background that you built for yourself on the tech side has really been enormously helpful. Seems like your skill set, combining that tech savvy media agency, go-go years of mobile and formative years of mobile and programmatic, has really set you up nicely for where you are now.
Yes, I'm quite a fatalistic person. I think most things happen for a reason. But the last 2 years have been incredible. We've had to learn an awful lot about what the product needs to look like, how advertisers want to work with us, which advertisers are really at the sort of spearhead of innovation. Working in a new way always takes a leap of faith, and not everyone's ready to do that right now. But the advertisers who we are working with are incredibly innovative, and are already seeing really amazing numbers from the way that we're working. So earlier I talked about the fact that only 30% of the open web is reachable or addressable. And we run audits for brands who want to work with us to tell them what their risk exposure is. And we call this a reachability score. And we are able to, within a couple of weeks, take somebody's reachability from 30% to over 80%. And what that means for a brand is that instead of having all of their activity pumped into 30% of the web. So they could be spending 90% of their programmatic budget to reach 30% of their audience. I mean, it's just wild. We're suddenly de-risking that for them and ensuring that they're spending 90% of their budget to reach 90% of where their audience is naturally distributed online. And, you know, for brands that need to grow in the iOS space, so if you were a technology brand or if you were a gaming customer, you know, you want to be able to reach users on Safari, this becomes business critical to you. And that's what we're able to deliver for customers, you know, in the here and now.
Great. Give us a sense as to where you think we'll be in a year. You know, dramatic change is promised by the biggest players in the business, and Google in particular, around the future of the cookie on Chrome. But where do you think we'll be a year from now on that issue?
I think already we're seeing a growing discontent with the status quo amongst the advertisers who we're speaking to in market. And that tends to be articulated in different ways. But the first one might be that I can't grow my brand. Like, I'm losing market share and category share, and I don't understand why. Help me understand why. The other is that I think there are technologies that advertisers are testing in the cookieless space now that they're having a little testing fatigue with. Perhaps they haven't delivered on what they said they would. And I think advertisers are going to get much more directive about what they want to see from cookieless partners. And they're going to sort of learn from what they've done so far. And the other big shift that I think will happen is within advertiser marketing teams, the cookieless and addressability issue is going to become someone's problem. So right now, where there is inertia in the market, I think it's driven by everyone knows this kind of juggernaut of change is coming, a bit like when we had GDPR. But sometimes there's not a single person who like owns this problem to fix it. And where we have seen great success with customers is this is one person's job to fix this. This one person is accountable. And I think as more businesses come to make it the chief marketing officer or the marketing director's job to say, we need to fix this, I think that's going to be a big change for next year.
Great, great stuff. And such an interesting area. I guess this is a quintessential watch this space, you know, over the course of the next year. Well, Elizabeth, this was so much fun. Thank you so much for joining us on Great Minds. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Thank you, Matt. So did I. I appreciate it.
You got it.